4 years ago, I guess, 3.5 years ago, in the geometry seminar, we organized some lectures about the work of the fields medalists after the International Congress. And this year, there's another International Congress, and it's a little bit before the International Congress, but there's already one piece of work that's generated a lot of interest and even made it to the national press as one of the 10 most important scientific advances of 2009. So I asked David if he would tell us about it, and he very kindly agreed. So David Bensby will talk about the fundamental level.
Great. Thank you very much. So this is slightly absurd talk, as you can probably tell from this diagram, which I'm going to try to roughly cover. So I'd like to give some sense of what the fundamental lemma is. The fundamental lemma is if a conjecture, well, it was a conjecture with a strange name. So it's a conjecture about conjugacy classes in p-adic groups. It's a conjecture due to Langlands and Shellsted. And it was recently resolved by Boucho and Go. So I'm not actually going to tell you what it is. But I'd like to tell you some of why you might care about it and some of the ideas that go into its proof and sort of where it fits in the grand scheme of things. But like I imagine most talks about this that you'll hear, you won't actually see a statement. But let me start with some things that we can give a statement for. So the basic formula that I want to start with is one that we're all pretty comfortable. Suppose we have an n by n matrix. So we have whatever its entries look like. We can assign to this matrix a trace. And so we can assign the trace of A. And the trace of A has kind of two different guises. On the one hand, the trace of A is just the sum of the diagonal entries of A. So this is a kind of a very, I don't know, maybe geometric is too strong a word, but this is a very direct formula. You just take your matrix, you sum up the diagonal entries. On the other hand, you can take the matrix and you can diagonalize it. Trace is invariant under conjugation. And when you diagonalize it, you can write this as the sum. This is the sum of the eigenvalues of the matrix. So we can call this spectral. This is something that's much more maybe meaningful. This tells you something about the spectrum of the matrix. This one is somehow easier, and this one is sort of maybe more meaningful. So this is the basic trace formula. The next kind of trace formula I want to talk about is for representations of a group. Suppose I have a group acting on a vector space. And to make everything I say really literally make sense, let's assume everything is the group's finite, the vector space is finite dimensional. So you suppose you have a representation of a group on a vector space, then you can assign to it, so generalization of this trace is the character of the representation. So the character is the function on the group which takes a group element and takes it to the trace of the corresponding matrix. To each group element, you have a matrix, you can take its trace. So this is the character. And again, the character, one of its main features is it's a class function. It's invariant under conjugation on the group. And so because it's a class function, you can write it in two bases for class functions. So there are two natural bases, one given by conjugacy classes. You can just look at a function that's one on a particular conjugacy class and zero elsewhere. And another basis is given by irreducible characters. So you assume that your representation is actually irreducible, you get a character, and these two form bases for class functions on the group. And again, I would like to say that these are kind of direct or geometric. You can just write down a conjugacy class. These might be harder. You have to figure out something about the representations here, but that's what you actually care about. This is the meaningful side. This is the spectral side. And so this is the part you can access. This is the part you care about. And the trace formulas are going to be ways to bridge the two. So let's actually give a formula. So everyone's taken in this beautiful. Exactly. It'll make about as much sense in the end, probably. So let's take an example. I'm going to take my, again, everything is finite. So I don't need to be very fussy what I mean by functions. I look at the cosets for G with respect to some subgroup gamma. Look at this finite set of cosets, look at functions on the cosets. And the group acts on this just by left, right multiplication on cosets. And in fact, the group algebra acts. So these are functions on the group, or if you'd like, they're just finite combinations of group elements. So linear combinations of group elements act on the representation. So it's more convenient to think in terms of these class functions, in terms of these group algebra, than in terms of just group elements. So if you give me such an element in the group algebra, it acts on this particular representation by a matrix, or what, to use maybe fancier terms, an integral kernel. Again, everything is totally finite here.
What's gamma?
Gamma is some subgroup. Take your favorite subgroup. Let me call it a discrete subgroup, but everything here is finite. So you can write it as a matrix. So where's the matrix? It's going to be matrix. The matrix entries are labeled by points in my finite set of cosets. So for any, I just write the corresponding matrix entry. And it's a nice exercise to write that the matrix entry corresponding to two points is just given by summing over the group of the value of my function evaluated on something of this form. You take your group element gamma and you conjugate it by these coset representatives. So I don't want to spend time on this. This is a nice group theory exercise. So once you have this explicit formula, you can now write a trace formula, which is due to Frobenius. In this case, this is a formula for the trace of an induced representation. And what it says is, well, it's going to have two sides. Let me write first the spectral side, because I'm not going to say anything about it. So you just you look inside of your representation, and you ask, what are all the irreducible representations that appear inside? And you could just write the character of your representation. If I write V as a direct sum of some representations pi with multiplicities, m sub pi, I could write the character as a sum of some coefficients, multiplicity, times the corresponding characters. So I haven't told you anything. This is just do your work, find the representation. But the left-hand side, the geometric side, so to speak, you can do a little exercise and find what the trace of that I gave you a matrix. Now take its trace, and a little manipulation will get it into this form. You take, I'm going to abuse notation, call it an integral. Remember, everything is finite, but I'm just going to call it an integral. You integrate over the conjugacy class of gamma. So it's an integral, and it's a sum over a subset of the group, which is things conjugate to gamma. And you integrate your function f. That's all it is. And there's just some little coefficient that you get, which is, if you'd like, I'm going to call it a volume. Again, volume just means sum of elements. You look at the centralizer of gamma in the group versus in the subgroup. Anyway, none of this is important for what I want to say. This is an example of the trace formula. It says trace on this explicit representation can be given by an explicit formula. And then it's what you want to understand. You want to understand what are the things that appear inside of here. So this is the Frobenius formula. And the main point about it is, again, on one side, we have representations that we care about. On the other side, we have something explicit that involves conjugacy classes. Now, there's one example of this formula that probably is that the right way up? I can't process at this point. That's part of the homework. Excellent. So I'm expecting a written response. Exactly. So now this formula works very generally. You don't really need things to be finite. For what you really need is you need gamma to be discrete, and you need G mod gamma to be compact for things to really work nicely. Otherwise, you have to think a lot harder. But in that case, it's due to Selberg, the exact same formula. And there's one example that probably most people have seen, which is you take the group G to be the real numbers, you take gamma to be the integers. And so here, my coset space is just the circle. L2 is what I mean by functions. Of course, you have to say what you mean by functions. L2 functions I can span by using the theory of Fourier series. It's the span of the e to 2 pi I n x. So in this case, I have an explicit description of functions on the circle. I know the right-hand side. And so if I give you a test function on the group, this is my version of the group algebra, I get a formula, which is the sum. Now there's no conjugacy. I don't have to conjugate. The conjugacy class is 1 point. You get the value of the function at an integer is you decompose it in according to these representations. You're just, those coefficients are just the Fourier transform of the function. So this is 2 pi I z. And this formula is the Poisson summation formula. So this is an example of the trace formula that we wrote in this infinite case. Now, this formula has lots of beautiful applications. And in old Texas tradition, we're supposed to mention Tate in every talk. So we'll, in particular, Tate's thesis basically says that we're going to, if you apply this formula, you apply Poisson summation. So you apply Poisson summation, and instead of the real numbers, you throw in for good measure the p-adic numbers. And you say, which p-adic numbers? Well, throw them all in. So this is very, like everything in this talk, it's going to be increasingly sketchy. But if you do Poisson summation where you replace the role of the real numbers by the so-called Adels, you recover class field theory. In other words, there's an interpretation of class field theory in terms of harmonic analysis, not on R, but on R and all the QPs together. What is class field theory? It's a study of the Galois group of, say, Q. I mean, there's versions for other number fields. The Galois group of Q bar over Q, well, that's like everything. But it's the abelian part, the abelianization of this group. If you want to understand this abelianization, you can do it completely by studying this kind of analysis on this space. So this is Tate's one of Tate's beautiful insights. OK. And I'm not talking fast, am I? All right. So so now, the given that, we do the one-line introduction to the Langlands program. So what's the Langlands program? I don't know how many M's and U's it has. But so the Langlands program is basically a non-abelian version of Tate's thesis. Non-abelian version. And it's kind of a, maybe I should have to add the word vast. It's kind of a vision of number theory and harmonic analysis as being tied by some really mysterious and amazing correspondence. To now be slightly more specific, what it does, it asserts that the mysteries of the universe, mysteries of the universe can be gotten out of harmonic analysis on very specific spaces, generalizing what we have over there, harmonic analysis on certain locally symmetric spaces. Okay. And again, what do we mean by mysteries of the universe? Mystery of the universe in this case means the Galois groups of number fields, the Galois group of Q bar over Q, and similarly for number fields. So many of the questions of number theory can be expressed in terms of Galois theory of number fields. And Langlands says that they can then be reinterpreted in terms of some kind of harmonic analysis of this kind. So let me be, let me give you at least some kind of context. All right, so what's the context? So the idea is that we're going to start, so we need non-abelian. So what's non-abelian? We start with G, reductive group over the rational numbers. So what does this mean? A reductive group of the rational numbers is it's something like that. You, let's keep in mind GLN, SLN, SON, SPN. So what are these things? Note that I haven't said GLNR or GLNC. These are things that you can plug in. These are all groups of matrices of some kind. So they're a collection of matrices, but we can plug in for our matrix coefficients. Well, you can plug in R. You can plug in Q. You can plug in p-adic numbers. and so on. So it's something in which you can make sense to say GLNR, GLNC, GLNQ, GLNQP. And that's what we mean. Okay, so we start with such a thing. And to such a thing, we're going to assign a space, on which we're going to do analysis, or harmonic analysis. So to such a thing, we assign a particular space. And I'm not going to give you the formula, except give you the example we all love. Let me just call it X sub G for lack of imagination. And this space X sub G, it's something that has a lot of symmetry. The main thing about this space X sub G, it's something on which has symmetry, which is this real Lie group, and also all these p-adic groups, which are the same matrices like GLN, just you plug in p-adic numbers for all p. It's a space with this kind of symmetry. Now, where do you find such a thing? We've all seen such a, the first of these. And the first thing is we take G to be SL2. And in SL2, I'm going to tell you what this X space is. This space is just the upper half plane modulo SL2Z. This is my X that I'm going to study. So what is the, this is, so where does this go? This is the home of modular forms. So every talk you've heard which mentions modular forms mentions the action of 2x2 matrices by integral matrices by linear fractional transformation on the upper half space. And the same talk probably also drew this picture, so I'll draw this picture. And either it means something or it doesn't. So this is our space. Now, I'm claiming that this space is one of our magical mystery spaces. It has all this great symmetry. Now, where's the symmetry coming from? Some of it is obvious and some of it is less obvious. So SL2R, the SL2R symmetry is clear just because you can take the upper half plane and you can act by fractional linear transformations, real fractional linear transformations act on the upper half plane. In fact, the upper half plane you can write as SL2R modulo the circle group, SO2, which is its maximal compact subgroup. So I'm being a little loose by symmetry. I don't mean literally that SL2R acts on this quotient space, but close enough. There's a circle bundle over this, which it acts on. So up to this little compact group, SL2R acts on this space. Okay, great. So this, so far, so good. Now, what's special about this space is it actually has a lot more symmetry that you might not see. It actually has the same relation to SL2QP for every p. And this was a discovery of Hecke. So these are what are called Hecke operators. So Hecke operators are kind of a shadow of the fact that this space can be written in terms of the p-adic SL2 for every p. In case that's a little oblique, let me, you can give a formula for this. You can actually write this space actually as a quotient, the same old upper half space, upper half plane mod SL2Z. You can write it in a different way, and I'm not going to say why, but there, you can also write it as roughly, probably going to lie at various points, but you'll get the drift. SL2QB, where V is a P or real numbers, and then you mod out by some maximal compact. So close enough. Anyway, this isn't completely irrelevant to my talk, except that there's a different way of writing the same space where you can see all this other symmetry. Okay. And there's a version of this. Once you write it this way, you can now generalize it to any group G. You can take your group G, you can look at G of Q, and you can look at G of these Adel numbers. So that's this product of all the QPs and the reals. There's a little prime here. And then you mod out by some compact subgroup. And this is your X. Okay. It's a formula, it seems completely oblique, I think, but this is what Langlands realized, that this space, this particular space, is kind of holds these mysteries of the universe in its representation, in its analysis. So, so Langlands introduces the notion of an automorphic representation, which is something that appears, this is something that appears in the spectrum of L2 of this space X sub G. You look at the space X sub G and you decompose it with respect to this huge amount of symmetry, and you see the basic atoms that appear in this decomposition, and those are called automorphic representations. And these are generalizations, these are kind of generalizations of modular forms. So if you think hard about modular forms for SL2, well, think really hard, you might come up with this generalization. So now, why is this the case? Well, that's another three lectures to even give a motivation. But just let's take it as a given that this space is sort of contains these kind of universal nuggets of truth. You look at the space and you decompose it into these little atoms under all its symmetries. Those atoms are these kind of universal nuggets of truth. And the Langlands program tells you that you really have to treasure them, and that they tell you everything about you want about Galois groups, the Galois groups of number fields, in some fairly oblique way. So you ask, what is that oblique way? Well, it's oblique. So the way you access these nuggets of truth is via the trace formula. So in this case, it's called the Arthur-Selberg trace formula. Now, what's the Arthur-Selberg? Well, Selberg did the case of SL2, this space. And Arthur, in this kind of monumental body of work, managed to generalize this to these other spaces. Now, so in some kind of criminally simplified way, I can write it as like I wrote before. And this is, maybe I'll have to cut this out of the video later. This is to be taken very philosophically. So it says something like it relates something like the formula we had before, so except that now the representations appearing on this right-hand side are what we call these automorphic representations. So you look at their multiplicity, and you look at trace of this operator. And here, F is now in the group algebra of, well, all of these, you know, say the real groups and all the p-adic groups. Take them all. They're all acting. And these are some kind of volumes again. And what is this? This is now basically a product of integrals over conjugacy classes in all the p-adic groups and in the real group, in these p-adic groups. Okay. So before we had conjugacy class, now we have a whole bunch of groups acting together, so you get a whole bunch of these things. Okay. This is really criminal partly because, well, the decomposition is not discrete. The spectrum of the space, these spaces are all non-compact. Their spectrum has a continuous part, it has a discrete part. They're both very complicated, and they're related in some complicated way. None of the operators are trace class. None of the integrals converge. You know, so this is all really needs to be taken very, you know. And this is what Arthur managed to do, is actually make a formula that looks roughly like this and is actually makes sense. So what the Langlands philosophy tells us is, well, we want to get at these kind of, let's maybe precious stones. These are kind of these really valuable things that we want. Now, the problem is you can't stare at this formula directly or you're going to be blinded. This is somehow the philosophy. You don't get anywhere by just looking at this mess. Where you get somewhere is by taking these precious stones and carrying them around, hoarding them with you. So you find one in one group, you find one somewhere else, someone hands you one, you find any technique in the world that will somehow grant you one of these little pieces, and then what you want to do is you want to carry it around with you. This is the entire philosophy of the Langlands program. It's kind of bizarre, but it somehow says you'd like to get to these guys, but the only way you can get them is by carrying them around. And this is in particular the way that you prove a lot of great things, in particular the Shimura-Taniyama conjecture. Shimura-Taniyama conjecture, this is relating elliptic curves and modular forms, was proved. This is sort of the main technical, one of the, maybe the hardest technical piece in the proof of that, which of course we know implies Fermat's last theorem. There are many, many things that are gotten out of that, many beautiful results have gone out of just working really hard with this and trying to pass information along. So now we're starting to get to this talk. What do we mean by pass information along? You have this formula, this one formula. Where am I going to pass it along? And the basic idea is that you want to compare, the way all the progress is made is you compare trace formulas. Now, and by saying compare trace formulas, I really mean compare the left-hand sides, because the right-hand side is where we'd like to go. We don't really understand this. By the way, again, this is called the spectral side, and this is called the geometric side. We want to compare these trace formulas for different groups. So this is what I meant by carrying these precious stones around. You find one for SL2, you find one for GL15, then you basically try to see, how do I relate this to something for another group? Okay, so the basic question you're asked now is, how do you possibly compare, well, the left-hand sides for different groups? Now, what is in the left-hand side? The key point here is you have conjugacy classes in these groups. So the basic question becomes, how do you compare conjugacy classes in different groups? And, well, there's a very natural answer, which is, if you just think about matrices, if I have a conjugacy class of matrices, I'm going to assume everything's diagonalizable just for, because I can. So if you have a conjugacy class of matrices, there's a basic numerical invariant. Namely, well, it's eigenvalues. So you can assign to a matrix, so here we may have a p-adic matrix, but the main idea is that it doesn't matter if you think of this as a real matrix or a p-adic matrix. For a matrix, you can assign its eigenvalues, or if you want to say it a little more symmetrically, you can say take its characteristic polynomial, or if you like to think spectrally or I don't know geometrically, you can take its spectrum of the matrix. Of course, that just means the eigenvalues, but I'm now going to draw it as a bunch of points. So the spectrum of the matrix is a collection of eigenvalues. These are all finite dimensional matrices, so the spectrum are just collections of points. So you can take these numbers, and you can say, all right, the way I'm going to compare conjugacy classes on group A with conjugacy classes on group B is if these numbers match up. So if I have something with eigenvalues 3 and 15, then I can try to find a conjugacy class in some huge, huge matrices just that happen to have eigenvalues 3 and 15 and the rest maybe 0. So you just carry around these eigenvalues, and that tells you how to compare conjugacy classes in different groups. And this is somehow the basic idea, and it works great for GLN. So what do I mean by characteristic polynomial for another group, I just mean you take invariant polynomials. So you take some polynomial function in the group that's invariant under conjugation. Anyway, there's a very beautiful and rich theory of these, and we'll ignore it. So this is the basic idea. You want to take these values. So now, where does the fundamental lemma come in? And this is the basic issue that you don't see when you're looking at GL2, but you see already for SL2. So let's look at SL2R. And okay, so if I look at semi-simple matrices in SL2R, they can be of the form A inverse. So you can have a matrix that's real diagonalizable. So that has eigenvalues somewhere between, minus 2. That is trace somewhere between minus 2 and 2, determinant 1. The other kind of matrices that you might run into in SL2R are rotation matrices. You can have cosine theta, sine theta, minus sine theta, cosine theta. And these have traces that live between minus 2 and 2. Okay, you just take these numbers and you can compare them with numbers you might think of another group, and that's how you might try to pass information along. Now, here's the basic issue. The basic issue behind everything is that if you take this matrix, let's call it R rotation by theta, take the matrix R theta, and now take the matrix R minus theta, rotation by minus theta, they have the same trace. They have the same invariant polynomials. So you'd like to think that they'd be conjugate. You'd like to think that what measures conjugacy classes is eigenvalues, is values of the characteristic polynomial. And in fact, these are, well, they are conjugate, right? So that wasn't exciting, except that they're conjugate in SL2C. So if you think what you need to conjugate one rotation this way, the rotation that way, you need a complex matrix. And this is the basic problem. their conjugate over the algebraic closure. So the algebraic closure is pretty close. If in a p-adic group, this gets algebraic closure is a lot further away. This is the basic problem. It's called the problem of stable conjugacy. So these two matrices, so this is what they're called stably conjugate. They're conjugate after you pass through the algebraic closure. Yet you need matrices with, you need to take some roots in order to conjugate the two of them. And what you will find is that characteristic polynomials only detect stable conjugacy classes. So stable conjugacy classes, all matrices in SL2R that can be conjugated, maybe using complex coefficients if you need to. And this is, I don't know if it sounds so, you know, horrific when you first see it, but this is the fundamental problem behind the fundamental lemma. What you'd, in order to get a trace formula that you could possibly work with, that you can really compare from group to group, you need to kind of have something that only depends on stable conjugacy classes, something that you can actually measure numerically. The way you're going to compare conjugacy classes is just by these numbers, these values of characteristic polynomial. If you have this issue, then you don't really know how to compare conjugacy classes in a good way. And so the fundamental lemma is something that enables you to deal with this problem. So what is the fundamental lemma? I'm not actually going to tell you what it is. But it's something to do with this. So this, well, maybe I'll tell you a little more. So this is the conjecture of Langlands and Schjelstad. And what it says is that, OK, the trace formula, as we wrote it, depended on conjugacy classes. So we'd like to rewrite it to only depend on stable things. We'd like whatever expressions we ever run into to treat r theta and r sub minus theta together, even though they're not conjugate. And in order to do this, you need to take these orbital integrals. So orbital integrals is just a fancy name for these averaging functions over a conjugacy class, maybe with some coefficient, which is this volume. So it's exactly the expressions. I didn't give them the name before. These expressions that we had before. So what it says, basically, is that you can orbital integrals on your group G, say a p-adic group. So for a real group, this is actually known. But you, Langlands and Schjelstad, or Schjelstad, that you can write these integrals so you can decompose them. Compose into integrals over stable conjugacy classes, so far so good, on different groups, on different Lie groups, which are called endoscopic groups. Okay, so what are we saying? We take this these funny stable conjugacy classes, they're broken up into these pieces, and the idea is that if you take appropriate linear combination of all these different pieces, like the piece containing r theta and piece containing r minus theta, that various linear combinations of these are actually sums over stable classes, but in a different collection of groups. So what are these groups? These are Lie groups. These are, and this is where things get really hard, and this is why I'm not stating things for you. There's just a lot of combinatorics. These groups are related to G, but in a funny combinatorial way. So they share related torus and vial group data, if you know and like this stuff. But they're not subgroups. So let me just give you one example. So if you take SO, get the order right. If you take SO2N, this is an endoscopic group for SP2N. You take symplectic 2N by 2N matrices. You take orthogonal 2N by 2N matrices. If you actually think about the groups, there's no relation between the groups. There's no map between them. But they're somehow coming into this decomposition. So what this fundamental lemma says is that you sum integral on one group can be written as a sum, basically, of integrals on other groups. Now, it's called the fundamental lemma because at the time, Langlands realized that this was sort of a crucial ingredient to everything he wanted to do. And he said, well, all right, let me prove it. He proved it for SL2 with Lebesgue. And then he says, OK, let's put it off. This is probably some combinatorial indebtedness about groups. And you know, it'll get solved soon. And that was over 20 years ago. So in the meanwhile, a lot happened. There's, I won't write all the names. The main names are Langlands, Schultstedt, Kottwitz, Waltz, Bourget, and Arthur. They showed that this fundamental lemma implies a lot of stuff. So it basically gives you this stable form of the trace formula. It gives you a form of the trace formula that you can compare between groups. And this can be applied to many, many things. For example, it's used in the recent proof of the Sato-Tate conjecture. Uses some form of this. You can use it to, you can ask, why do I care about comparing groups? If you're a representation theorist, you can reduce, in some sense, representation theory of classical groups, things like SOs and SPs and whatever, you can reduce them to representation theory of GLN, which you understand much better. So this is an achievement of Arthur. There are many, many beautiful consequences, but they all depend on this mysterious thing. Okay. So that's the fundamental lemma. So all the articles you'll see on this just write in the beginning what the fundamental lemma is, and I think at that point you sort of drop the article, because it's really kind of, yeah, because then the rest of the article, the next 20 pages, are, you know, there's a paper of Tom Hales saying, you know, a statement of the fundamental lemma. It's like a 20-page paper just stating it. What I would like to convince you in the rest of the time, well, first I want to tell you something about how it was finally proved by Ngo. And the thing about this proof is it's not a stupid combinatorial check. It's not somehow you work really hard with these integrals and you check it. It involves really beautiful new ideas and kind of tells you about some deeper things that are going on. So it turns out to really be fundamental. So now I'm going to, you know, appeal to magic. Maybe a better word would be to use logic. So there's what to me seems like a crazy result, but I'm sure people understand logic understand much better. And this logic result tells you that you can replace the p-adics by something you like, or I like, a lot better. Now, what does this say? So the p-adics are this field of characteristic zero. But they look a lot in some ways to Laurent series in a single variable in characteristic p. So this is a field of characteristic p. This is a field of characteristic zero. This kind of looks like Laurent series in the number p in some sense. But they look similar. And what logicians will tell us is that they're actually logically, the logical theories of these two fields are closely enough related that some results can actually be carried over. So there's a theorem of, I think it's Kluckers, Hales, and Waltz-Bourget. Kluckers, Hale, and Lozère. Using logic, they showed that the fundamental lemma for, you look at the same exact statement, but you just by hand replace QP by Laurent series in T. It suffices to prove this for almost all, almost all P. So if you actually knew the fundamental lemma in characteristic zero, sorry, characteristic P for these Laurent series in T, then because of logic, you'd know it for the actual question you cared about. So in this case, there's actually another proof by Waltz-Bourget, which I think is somehow this brute force. You actually look at the structure, the Galois groups, and you find enough relations, enough similarity that you can somehow do this. But this is, so this I take as a black box. Now you might say that everything in this talk is a black box, but this is somehow even more so. So now we've gone from QP to Laurent series T. What have we gained? Well, it turns out you've gained a lot, because now you're in the world of algebraic geometry. So now you can reinterpret the fundamental lemma, and this is a reinterpretation due to Kajdan and Lustig and Bernstein. The interpretation says, well, once you're in over a finite field, there's an amazing machinery of algebraic geometry. In particular, the main thing is the main ingredient is the Wey conjectures, the Dillean. And what this tells you is that various integrals or various numbers can be realized geometrically. So when you write down what these actual integral over these conjugacy classes look like, you find that they're actually counting numbers of points on some algebraic variety defined over a finite field. And using algebraic geometry, you can write these orbital integrals orbital integrals are actually calculating, once you're in this setting, are calculating Euler characteristics. Characteristics of some singular algebraic varieties over your finite field. So all of a sudden, you're now in the setting of algebraic geometry over this field. You can interpret this integral as an Euler characteristic, as something geometric. These varieties are called affine Springer fibers. Affine Springer fibers. And to give you an idea of what they are, you take, say, a Grassmannian manifold, you take a matrix, and you look at the collection of all points in a Grassmannian that are fixed by this particular matrix. So in other words, you look at all subspaces that are preserved by a particular matrix. That's an example of a Springer fiber. And those actually end up being very complicated singular spaces. And that's what these are. These are things of that form. You take some Grassmannian, and you take the fixed points of some matrix, except that now everything is done over Laurent series. But that's the basic idea. So you can understand everything geometrically. And now for the geometers in the audience, at this point, you breathe a sigh of relief, because once you're at this Euler characteristic stage, I might as well replace FP by, say, the complex numbers. So the geometry is the same. There are various comparison results tell me I can think of these Euler characteristics by just taking my complex variety and take this complex Grassmannian, you take a complex matrix and look at its fixed point set. I might as well think I'm over here. So for the rest of the talk, we can be over C. So by this chain of logic plus this Weyl conjecture machine, you now have a question about Euler characteristics. And you're like, OK, we should be done. And this is the point where, say, Goreski, Kottwitz, McPherson come in. And they kind of said, well, we ought to be done. We know lots about this geometry. We know lots about Euler characteristics. And they made a lot of detailed study of this. And they interpreted the fundamental lemma in this language. The problem is, though, we still have the same old problem. OK, before it was integrals on two different groups. Now it's Euler characteristics of two different manifolds or singular varieties. There are no maps between these varieties. You might say, well, you try to relate them by some. There's no maps between them. They're just completely different looking things. And so again, you ask, how are you possibly going to dig in and understand these Euler characteristics? And they developed a technique that works in some cases. And they proved them and Lamont, they proved some cases of this using hard work. But this is where this stood until the last however many few years. And so now I finally get to tell you about NGO. There are a lot of names that I probably should have written down. I mean, as you can tell, this story is built on works of a lot of amazing people. But in any case, NGO proved this statement, but he proved it by embedding it in a totally different and much more geometric story. He added a lot of structure to what's going on, and this is what I'd like to tell you about. The structure is something that you can actually, there's some very beautiful structure you can access. Okay, so let me just say it. Let me just, I have kind of three steps that I'd like to tell you about. There's globalization. There's new symmetries, and then to use a word that I like, categorification. So you'll see that the one reason people like in the geometric language program are so excited about this because it gives us sort of a justification for what we're doing. Because we've been doing all this kind of abstract nonsense about Riemann surfaces, and we say it's somehow related to the language program, but well, what can you show for that? And Go's proof really uses ideas coming out of geometric language, the same structures, to prove this amazing result. And so we're all very excited. Feel justified. So now since we have lots and lots of time, let me tell you about the analogy between number fields and function fields. Analogy of number fields and function fields. So let's remind you of the story. We started with a problem about a number field. We reduced it to a problem about p-adic numbers. We translated it to FP Laurent series T. And what NGO does is he now globalizes it again, makes it a problem about function fields, a global problem. So in the analogy, and I'm going to ignore most of the time the middle column. So I have a number field, say Q, and I can look at Laurent series or rational functions on, So take a curve over a finite field. You can look at the field of rational functions on a curve over a finite field. It's a very long-standing, I don't know, 200 whatever year old, 150 years old analogy between these two things. But these two fields look very similar. But we're doing geometry. We're just going to take a Riemann surface. If you take a Riemann surface, and so now I mean Riemann surface, and you took look at the field of rational, look at meromorphic functions on this Riemann surface, and this field is somehow an analog of Q or of a number field. So you should think of the analog log of a number field as being a Riemann surface. And again, the way this works, we have these completions, QP and the real numbers. These are completions. And these all look terribly different from each other. All the QPs are very different. But here, if you look at a curve at near each point, and you look at kind of meromorphic functions near each point, they just look like a Laurent series. If you take a Riemann surface, near all the points look the same. Near each point, functions near that point just look like a Laurent series in one variable. So that's one of the advantages of function fields. So this here, we had this problem that we went from QP to FP, and now we're going to go to this global setting. So now remember, in our global setting, the whole story was about this analog of the upper half plane mod SL2Z, this locally symmetric space. So we have this space X mod G, and you could ask, what does it become in this setting? And it has a very nice answer. The space XG, let's just do GLN. If you look at XGLN, the analog for Riemann surface is something very nice. It's the space, or we like to put the word moduli in front. It's just the space of all rank n vector bundles on this Riemann surface. So if you replace number fields by function fields, this crazy spaces become moduli spaces, spaces of rank n vector bundles on the Riemann surface. Now, rank n vector bundles on a Riemann surface is something you can think of very concretely. But if you actually try to look at the collection of all of them, the space of all of these, let's call this bun n, this space is a very complicated kind of nonlinear space. But it's studied a lot in physics and studied in a lot of places. And Hitchin, motivated by ideas in gauge theory, Hitchin discovered a very beautiful structure that enables you to understand the space geometrically. And then Go realized that what Hitchin introduced was exactly the structure you need for the fundamental lemma. So let me give you the two-minute version of the Hitchin space. So Hitchin says, let's take the space of rank n vector bundles. I'm going to embed it in something bigger. And this is the space, let me call it MN sigma. This is what he called Higgs bundles. So the Higgs is supposed to tell us there's physics somewhere. It's pretty far, but anyway. So we take V eta. Well, maybe it's not. You look at V as your rank n bundle like before, but now we add a Higgs field. So eta, and what is the Higgs field? It's a fancy name for just an endomorphism of this bundle. So I'm just going to look at a bundle together with a matrix acting on it. So you have a vector bundle. It's a collection of vector spaces. And on each vector space, I want a matrix. And this should be holomorphic. So holomorphic endomorphism of this bundle. So, okay, now what's the advantage is that Hitchin discovered a map from this space to some auxiliary data, some space of other Riemann surfaces, that sit inside of my Riemann surface original one cross the complex numbers. Now, what is this construction? This construction is something very simple and beautiful, so I'm going to tell you. What is this construction? If I give you, what can you, well, you know, we're talking about conjugacy classes and spectra and so on. If I give you, here's my Riemann surface sigma. That's a bad picture. Here's my complex number C. Now, I have a vector bundle. So at each point of sigma, I have a vector space V. And it has an endomorphism eta. At each point, I have this endomorphism. Okay, what can I do with an endomorphism? You can graph its spectrum. Endomorphism, it's a matrix up to conjugation. Makes sense to talk about the eigenvalues of this matrix. So here's my matrix. I graph in C, graph its eigenvalues. Just draw the spectrum. But now, we have a whole Riemann surface worth of endomorphisms. And so what we get is a new Riemann surface which is a branched cover. It's an n-fold branch cover, if the bundle is rank n. It's an n-fold branch cover of sigma. So this is just a fancy version of saying, take a matrix, take a spectrum, which is what we've been talking about all along. So Hitchin realized that this gives you a very beautiful thing. You take this space, you take this data, and all you remember is basically the zeros of the characteristic polynomial, or you know, the spectrum. And that gives you this nice vibration. In particular, here, this was eta equals 0. We didn't have any endomorphism, so you don't get any interesting Riemann surface. You just get the 0 section. So, but if the endomorphism is nice enough, you get a nice Riemann surface. And you can ask, how do you recover the rest of the data? How do you recover V and eta from this? Well, you need one extra data. If I give you a matrix, an endomorphism, it's not enough to know its eigenvalues. I should also tell you its eigenspaces. So I take this Riemann surface. Each point here, remember, that's an eigenvalue of eta. So I draw a line here, which is the corresponding eigenspace. Okay? So when I draw all of these eigenspaces together, I get a line bundle. Again, if everything is generic enough, I get a line bundle on sigma. And what you find is that the space MN sigma is really the space of these sigma tildes plus line bundles. Now, this is a huge advance. Why is this a huge advance? Well, it's telling us that here, if we look over 0, we get this terribly complicated space, the space bun n. But if you fix a nice Riemann surface, and you look at the fiber over that, so what is the fiber over that? It means you fix your sigma tilde, and you look at all of the things that give rise to the same sigma tilde, the fiber, so this just tells you that the fiber over sigma tilde is the Jacobian of sigma tilde. It's the space of line bundles, or Picard if you are more careful. So it's line bundles on sigma, which is a torus. This is just S1 to the two times the genus. So these fibers are as nice as you could possibly ask for. So you have this zero fiber, which is terribly complicated. But if you move a little bit away, you deform away, you get these beautiful things which are just tori. So this is Hitchin. So Hitchin discovered that there's a beautiful dynamical system acting on this, which, at least on the nice locus, is just straight line flow on these. This is what an integrable system is. It's something that looks like straight line flow on tori. Okay, so all right, so we're kind of running out of time. So what let me just say the first main idea of Ngo is he realized that the fundamental lemma is really about, it's about the looking at the Euler characteristics of these Hitchin fibers of the Hitchin map. So before we had these affine Springer spaces, I didn't know what to tell you about them. But now we have these fibers of the Hitchin map, and what we're actually asking about is look at these Hitchin systems for different groups and compare the geometry of the Hitchin system for group G and a group, some other group. And that you can do really geometrically, because you can compare these kind of curves. These sigma tilde are things you can reduce down to the combinatorics. You can relate these for group G and these other crazy endoscopic groups. This is now something you can, the Hitchin systems for these endoscopic groups, and Ngo showed were directly geometrically related. So all of a sudden you have, and you can ask, where did we go? So we now have an interpretation that's global, a global statement about the geometry of Riemann surfaces. You can ask, how does this relate to the local picture? And the point is that somehow all of the interesting information ends up being concentrated at the ramification points. Away from the branch point, nothing interesting is happening. And so you can really reduce all the information to something about these points, and that's how you get back to your Laurent series field. But now we're in a much, much nicer global geometric situation where we're just looking at this family of tori, which are maybe degenerating and becoming nasty at some point. But we have a beautiful geometry to study them. All right, I'm kind of out of time. Let me just tell you I'm going to take 3 more minutes. So the second thing that Ngo realized is symmetries. And let me just tell you what the symmetry principle he discovered is in 2 words. That if you have, this is what people, I think, in analysis call functional calculus. If I have a matrix A, it makes sense to talk about something of the form f of a, where f is a function on the real line. So this is a basic construction. Once we have a spectral theory of operators, we can make sense of applying to a matrix and finding a whole bunch of new matrices. So we have this collection, f of a are these new matrices that commute, commuting matrices. Now, if you ask how many new matrices are there, well, a matrix is only n by n. Its spectrum is only n points. And by the Cayley-Hamilton theorem, A satisfies its own characteristic polynomial. So actually, all you really care about, you don't care about all random crazy functions on the real line. You just care about functions on the spectrum of A is really all that matters. And the spectrum of A is just n points. So you get an n-dimensional space of matrices commuting with a given one. So that's all you're doing. Now, this is very elementary. What N'Gaud did is he found an equally elementary version for an arbitrary group, which I can explain to you in 10 minutes. It's an incredibly elementary construction, but somehow was completely missing. He showed that for any group, there's a version of this. For any element in the group, you can find a collection of commuting elements of a perfectly nice right size. It's always n-dimensional, always dimension is the rank, and varies really nicely. And then what he showed is that when you do that over a Riemann surface, you get a new group of symmetries that act on this Hitchin system, and if you'd like, integrate the dynamical system. Actually, it's a group of global symmetries. Rather than having these flows, it's actually the global group of symmetries. And so that's kind of the new symmetry principle. And now the final piece, and here's, I think, another beautiful thing he said. We said, instead, we had these Euler characteristics. These are the numbers. And I keep saying how hard it is to compare these numbers for different groups. You need some equality from numbers. Numbers are really hard. So what's better than numbers? Vector spaces. So instead of looking at Euler characteristics, just look at the cohomology. The cohomology is an actual nice vector space. And now, because of all these geometry, this cohomology carries an action of some small group, this N'Gaud symmetry group. It carries an action of a group. Now, if I give you a number, doesn't carry an action of a group. I mean, it's just a number. But a vector space can carry an action of a group, and now you can try to decompose it according to the action of this group. And N'Gaud realized that this decomposition of the cohomology of these Hitchin fibers according to this group of symmetry exactly is the fundamental lemma. That decomposition of one orbital integral into a sum of others, once you pass the geometry, it's just taking this cohomology and breaking it up into symmetries of this group. And I'm way over time. Thanks.